Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, opera librettist Jean Shearer discusses the process of transforming Herman Melville's Moby Dick into a critically acclaimed opera. He is joined by Northwestern University professor Betsy Erkla. This conversation originally took place April 24th, 2019, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the American Writers Museum. I'm Sonal Shukla. I'm the Assistant Director of Programs and Education. All right, so tonight we're gathered to celebrate the Chicago Opera Theater's production of Moby Dick, based on Herman Melville's American masterpiece of obsession and survival on the merciless sea. Here to talk about the novel and the opera are librettist Jean Shearer and Melville scholar Betsy Erkla. With composer Jake Heggie, Jean Shearer has collaborated on many projects, including Moby Dick, Three Decembers, the Houston Grand Opera, which starred Frederica von Staudt, and the lyric opera and the lyric drama To Hell and Back, which was by Philharmonica Baroque Orchestra, which featured Patti LuPone. His oratorio, August 4, 1964, for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra was nominated for a Grammy in 2012, and his adaptation of Cold Mountain won an International Opera Award in 2015, as well as another Grammy nomination. Betsy Erkla is the Henry Sanborn Noyce Professor for Literature at Northwestern University. Her teaching and research are in the field of American literary and cultural studies, and she has been awarded fellowships by the Guggenheim Foundation, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Welcome you both.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming, and I'm delighted to share with you some of the history of the writing of this opera and some of the decisions we made and choices along the way. First of all, the opera was commissioned initially for a premiere in 2010 by the Dallas Opera. The Dallas Opera at the time was opening a new opera house called the Winspear Opera House, and to celebrate the grand opening of this fantastic new theater, they wanted to start with a bang, and so they commissioned Jake Heggie, to the composer, to write an opera. And at the time, it was meant to be done by Jake and Terrence McNally, although obviously the very prominent playwright. And Terrence and Jake talked about what they wanted to do, and Terrence suggested Moby Dick, and Jake called the person at the head of the Dallas Opera and said, we'd like to do Moby Dick. And there was a pause on the phone, and the general director said, anything else? But he convinced them that it was a good idea. And then what happened was Terrence, who was absolutely fine, but at the time had a health emergency, wasn't able to do it. Jake and I had been working on other projects, and I stepped in to do it. The piece hadn't been started yet, so I came in and I wrote the opera. But the actual idea for the opera was Terrence's. That is the idea of doing an opera based on Moby Dick. And Jake called me up and said, what do you think? And I said, let me read it. I hadn't read it since high school, and even then I'm sure I skipped a whole lot of it. That cetology thing didn't really play too well when I was 17 years old. But I did read it, and I saw immediately that there was incredible operatic potential. There were obviously huge challenges on how to tell the story, but there was obviously the incredible language is an asset for an opera. This central, opera does big well. It does these big, themes well, and then the music is there to sort of illuminate the subtlety of the subjects. And so I thought that was a really very good point of departure. And then, of course, how do you do it? How do you tell this story, which is so sprawling, and how much do you cut, and how much do you... it's not just a question of cutting it, but how much do you distill and sort of conflate and change things so that it will work in an operatic form? I'm happy to answer questions and so forth, but I'll just say this, that you know, one of the things about this novel or any novel is there is of course a narrator, a person who's telling you the story, who's sort of omniscient or certainly knows the story, and can tell you what people are thinking and what's happening, and not just the events, but what it feels like, what the oceans feels like, what it sounds like, all of those things. And you know, in an opera, you'd say there isn't a narrator, but yet there is. The narrator is the composer. And so my task is not to, as a librettist, is not to write a play which stands on its own. It's something that needs to be completed by the music, and ultimately is the scaffolding that allows music to do what it does best, which is to communicate the emotional content of a story. You know, what I'm involved in is the art of sort of emotional archaeology. That's what opera is, because it's not like a film where you can tell a thousand different facts about, you know, what the story is, or even the novel that's, you know, 900 pages long and all of the details of all of these things. So I cut sort of mercilessly in terms of how I crafted the story, and I'm happy to talk about that during the course of the evening. But the question is, what happens with all of that stuff that gets cut? What happens with all that stuff that winds up on the sort of the cutting room floor of an operatic process? And my interpretation is that it becomes reinvented, reimagined as music, and even though those details are not coming, the emotional content that's in the book. So whether it is the cetology in the book, the idea of these young whales that are just growing, that are just born, you can feel that in the music. You can feel the obviously the storms and all of those things you can feel in the music. But all of the subtleties that are, or many of, I say all, many of the subtleties that are woven throughout this brilliant novel become reimagined in a musical form, because that's why, for those of us who love opera, and I hope this many of you do, and we'll certainly give this a chance, because I think it's a beautiful piece. Jake has written a gorgeous score. You're feeling the experience reinterpreted in a musical form.
So it's interesting, because when I was first asked to talk to Gene about the opera that he's written on Moby Dick, Moby Dick is so huge, right? And I guess my first question, and we've just talked about that a little bit, is, oh, you're doing an opera on Moby Dick. Which one? Mm-hmm. And I mean, possibly some of you have seen the Gregory Peck version of Moby Dick, and on the one hand, it's pretty dated, and they didn't have the special effects or anything. But we were talking about the fact that he decided to focus on the relationship between Starbuck and Ahab. In the context of the Cold War, and it really does sort of work as a film, but what really gets left out, which is for me the major part of the story, is the whole incredible relationship between Ishmael and Queequeg. So in just the little conversation that we've had together, I'm delighted to know that Gene is actually emphasizing that relationship, because it's so key and so ahead of its time. Both my other guy that I work on, both Walt Whitman and Herman Melville were very brave in their representation of same-sex love, way ahead of their time, and they make it a kind of metaphor of democracy. And one of the things, I mean, I probably shouldn't say this because it's obscene, but what's fascinating about Melville and Whitman in the 19th century is both Whitman's Song of Myself and Melville's Moby Dick have this very overt kind of masturbatory scene that is in the context of also democracy. And when I teach Moby Dick, we say, what is the relationship between masturbation and democracy? Why is it that our epic prose writer and our epic poet have this, you can't miss it, a squeeze of the hand. Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. Oh, squeeze. It's just, and then Whitman is a similar scene in the middle of Song of Myself. And so that's just to open the question. The other thing we started talking about is one of the things that most people don't think about when we start Moby Dick. Famously, do you know how it begins? The first words are, call me Ishmael. And what's wonderful about that is, does that mean his name is Ishmael? Or do we just call him Ishmael, right? But what we don't recognize when we begin the novel is that this character has just survived a traumatic, in fact, finally, apocalyptic loss in terms of his life boy, Queequeg. He survives on his coffin, but everybody except Ishmael. And so I was delighted to hear from Gene that he, I believe you said, and maybe you can, I think you said that you end the opera with Call Me Ishmael, with the beginning, which I have to say, I think is brilliant.
Thank you. Just to explain that a little bit, in terms of how I went about sort of distilling the novel, you can't put, obviously you can't put these 800 pages on the stage. So I focused on these two relationships. Yes, the relationship, of course, between Ahab and Starbuck. Ahab, who's obsessed with gaining revenge, and also with creating control in a world, as we all know, where control in the end is impossible to obtain. And he's fighting this you know, so heroically and yet tragically. And of course, Starbuck, who is the sane voice on the boat, who realizes that he's being led, the whole crew is being led to destruction, and yet he also is unable to act for his own reasons. So I focus on that obvious sort of choice of Ahab and Starbuck. The other relationship, as we were just discussing, is between Queequeg and the character Ishmael in the book. Now, one of the things that struck me when I first read the book, in preparation for writing the opera, was that, curiously, Ishmael is the only character in the novel who's never been on a whaler. He's been at sea before, but he's never been on a whale ship before. Everyone else is an experienced hand at some point and somewhere along the way. And that struck me as a very interesting thing. And this idea of, and he's even referred to at one point as greenhorn, a person who's never been on a whaler. He doesn't know how to do it. He doesn't know what the tasks are. And, you know, the Melville story starts kind of beautifully with this lost young man, Ishmael, who is lost in his life. He's going to coffin warehouses, he's following funerals, he's really thinking about ending his own life. Whether he will actually do it or not is another question, but certainly he's not in a good place when the story begins. And at the end, of course, of this whole 800-page novel, he is the survivor. He's the one who's floating on Queequeg's coffin and wants to survive. He wants to be rescued. So that is, you know, there is this journey that he's going on, which is, it's a journey of facts and storyline, but it's an emotional journey. So I made the choice to call this character Greenhorn through the entire piece because, as we just referred to, everything that you see, everything that's cited in the book is being remembered by Ishmael. But it's much more dramatic, and I'm in the business of creating drama. And it's much more engaging to watch someone in real time have these experiences rather than me telling you. I'll give you an example in La Boheme. I don't know if you folks know La Boheme, but okay. So Mimi comes up the stairs into this garret. She wants to get her candle lit, and she sees this really handsome guy and, you know, Rodolfo, these two young, you know, lovers, poor people, but you know, poor kids, you know, living in this garret. She's downstairs. He sees her, and he's going, oh, my God, she's so gorgeous. She's so fantastic. And she wants to get her candle lit. So he lights the candle, and her key falls on the floor. And they both get down on their knees, and they're looking for the key, and he finds the key. And he takes the key, and he puts it in his pocket, and then he pretends that he hasn't found it because he wants to find her hand. He wants to touch her. And then he touches her hand, and when he does, he sings, Que gelida menina, how cold your little hand is. And then she sings about, you know, mi chiamano mimi. So she tells her story. Now, the other way I could have done that is like, Puccini, I should say, me, from my mouth to God's ears. There were other ways that the librettist and Puccini could have told that was they could have had someone say, you know, 4 weeks ago, this beautiful woman came up the stairs and she had her candle, and I could just tell the story, but it's not as dramatic. It's not as you know, emotionally engaging as watching it unfold. So getting back to Moby Dick, how could I create, this is a story that is told in the novel, but I want to show it in real time. So I create this character of this greenhorn who is not referred to as Ishmael for the entire piece, until the last line of the piece where he's had this transformative relationship with Queequeg. He's seen every different way of living one's life represented by all these different characters. There's Flask, who's kind of just stupid, a person who just doesn't think about how they're going to live their life. There's Starbuck, who laughs his way through life. There's Stub, who laughs his way through life. There's Starbuck, who has a religious perspective, and that's how he that's
Quaker.
How yeah, yeah. A Quaker, who and that's how he sort of governs his life. And there's all these different ways. And then there's Queequeg, who's sort of poised between all of these different ways, and he is, you know. He's actually represents a truthful way. He's this Samoan prince who, as you know, winds up first scaring this greenhorn character, and then ultimately becoming someone that he loves deeply and transforms his life. So that yes, at the end of the opera, as we were just talking about, when the captain of the Rachel, the Pequod has been destroyed, and Greenhorn is laying on, after a day or so, is laying on top of this coffin, and he says, who are you? And he says, call me Ishmael, and he's rescued. And the idea is that he's now had this whole experience, so he is now ready to write the book. He's now, he can go home, and then after he gets his, you know, himself together, he can sit down and write down the book. But it's much more engaging to tell it in that way. So that's sort of what we have.
Yeah, I'm wondering. I haven't seen it. I'm going to see it, but I'm wondering how. I always tell my students that, and those of you who haven't read Moby Dick yet should just read the first chapter, because in some ways the first chapter is full of the language that sort of anticipates what's going to happen. And one of the images that sticks with me from the first chapter is that moment where Narcissus is gazing into the pond, and we're hearing that, and he sees himself and falls in love with the image that is there, and he falls in and dies. So that, and that whole question of mirroring, mm-hmm. of is what we see out there, is it really out there? Or are we just only seeing mirrors of our own internal idea of the world is raised really strongly in terms of Moby Dick as not just a good story about whaling. And by the way, in the 19th century, people thought Melville was absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy. There was an article, there was a review that said a writ de lunatico ought to be issued for him writing this stupid novel about this mad captain and the crazy whale. They loved, the reviewer loved, guess what? The whaling chapters. It was a huge, industry. It was a major industry in the 19th century, and people wanted to know about whaling. And so that was why the novel was popular, and all this other stuff seemed like craziness. And so Melville was not really understood until the post-World War I period. It was not until then that Melville started to be understood. It was almost like the world needed to catch up with Herman Melville before it could be understood. So I was just wondering, in that particular instance or other places in Moby Dick, some of those moments where the language becomes so important if you do try to do something.
Well, there's language that's threaded throughout the piece that's from the book. People always ask me how much of it is from the book and how much did you write. It's about 50-50, I'd say. And most of what you'll hear, for those of you who go, and I do hope you go, most of what Ahab sings is from the book. And then there's the symphony chapter between Starbuck and Ahab towards the end of the opera, which is also pretty much from the book. And then a lot of the other stuff I wrote, and because I'm not putting the novel on the stage, I'm trying to create, as I said before, the scaffolding that allows music and to conflate the story in a way that so that the audience can feel it, and that the music has the opportunity to communicate it. It's interesting. I mean, in terms of this notion of the duality between what is out there and what's inside, that's the beautiful thing of music. Because you know, you could be singing words, and the music that you're singing is revealing what's on the inside, or what you're suppressing, or what you're trying to discover. So there's always a sort of duality that's built into the nature of music, and it sort of aligns, I think, well with this story. You know, it's interesting, sort of the history of Moby Dick. You know, Melville was on a whaler. He was on the Acushnet in 1843, and he had this experience. And I don't know how many of you know this, but a great American writer is in this wonderful museum, who's still writing today, Nathaniel Philbrook, who's written many wonderful books, including a book called In the Heart of the Sea, which was about the Essex. Do you know, folks know about the Essex? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, just for those who don't, I'll just give you a little bit of quick background. The Essex was a whaler that was taken down by a huge sperm whale. And the crew, I guess they made a movie of it recently. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't see the movie, but they made it after we did the opera. And these like six or seven, it was cannibalism and this whole crazy story. But what's interesting is that the way in which Melville found out about it, when he was on the Acushnet, there was a gam, and which gams are when these boats would meet on the ocean. You'd be out for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and they would exchange letters, and they would exchange newspapers and stories. And one time when he was out at sea on the Acushnet, someone had a copy of Owen Chase's journal about what happened on the Essex. And it was, you know, he wrote this book in 1849, 1850, 1851. And through the 1840s, Melville was writing successfully. He was actually writing successful big sea yarns that were successful. And when he started writing Moby Dick, that was what his intention was. It was not to write this big, epic, imaginative, to reinvent the world of literature effort. And he was almost done with the book, as I understand it, in 1850. And something incredibly important happened in his life. He met Nathaniel Hawthorne up in the Berkshires. And he loved Hawthorne, and he was looked up to Hawthorne, and Hawthorne had this huge impact on Melville and convinced him that this sea tale he was writing could be so much more. He didn't call his publisher, but he got in front of his publisher, as I understand it, and said, I need more time, and he rewrote and the book to that became what we have today. And of course, if you look on the first page of Moby Dick, it's dedicated to Hawthorne. So there was this very important relationship between the two, and that's how this, you know, how it happened. It's just it's an incredible story.
Yeah, I have. That's interesting. I have a slightly different version
You're probably right. You're the academic.
No, but that Melville wrote these popular novels that were Typee and Omu and they were really popular, and he could make money. He could have made money, but he wanted to write truth. And he said, as Gene is saying, his relationship with Hawthorne was so important because he had reviewed Hawthorne, and he believed that Hawthorne had an absolute sense of the evil of the world, without which any normal human being cannot really be human if you don't recognize that blackness, 10 times black, he says, of the world. But really, in some ways, that review is more about Melville than Hawthorne. Hawthorne was kind of the golden boy and good looking and had a beautiful wife and was very successful, the only American writer who was completely successful in his time and has continued successful. Melville, not so much. But when he started writing Moby Dick, he wanted to write truth, but it didn't sell. Go to the soup kitchens. And what he tried to do, and in some ways he didn't succeed, but it's brilliant. If you think about the title, it's not just Moby Dick. It's Moby Dick or the whale. And at every point, he's trying to, on the one hand, enlist the 19th century audience attention with all these whaling chapters, and on the other hand, turn whaling into this incredible symbolic performance of the nature of the universe. And you've got the mad captain, and you've got the relationship between the savage and the civilized through Ishmael and Queequeg, and you've got all this other stuff. And it didn't work finally, but it's kind of, he's using fact and symbol and trying to somehow both sell the novel on the whaling at the same time that he gets to write this incredibly prophetic book that right now, I mean, is seen as one of the major books in the world. And it is certainly, I think, I mean, yeah. I would say our prose epic, just as Whitman's Leaves of Grass is our poetic epic. But he didn't, it wasn't that way at the time.
Why don't we open up to questions, and we can certainly talk more. But do you have questions? Yes, ma'am. That's a great question. What comes first, the music or the words? Well, historically, and the way opera is written and has been written from Mozart, Puccini, going way back, is the words come first, and they always do and always have. Because when you really think about it, the words, the music needs to reflect what the drama is and what the structure of the story is and what the, you know, it's not just what one dramatic moment is, but how, because it's a huge piece of music, how it relates, how these leitmotifs that are threaded through the entire piece. So the composer, he or she, has to have the entire libretto. Basically, it will change as they're writing it, because the music will sometimes give us information about the characters that we didn't have before as it's being written. But the words come first. And just I just digress for a second, just because I think this is kind of an interesting. I hope this is an interesting way of looking at it, even though it's a reference to musical theater, folks. But it's an interesting, because in musical theater sometimes, because musical theater is based on, blooms out of popular music, by and large, and has historically. And when I think about the difference between the way Rodgers and Hart wrote and Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote, what's interesting is that, you know, Lawrence Hart was brilliant, absolutely incredible genius, but he had huge alcohol problems and lots of other problems, and he would really only write when he was in the room with Richard Rodgers. And they would write their songs together, And what happens is that if you think about those songs, they become, I would call them wit-based. He was such an incredible wit, Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, My Funny Valentine, and so forth. And these songs, because they're wit-based, become, and not, this is where I'm going with this, not character-based. They become the great American songbook of the cabaret. You know, those are the songs you want to sing, because it's not a specific person who's singing. It could be anyone who's singing those songs. It was the music, he would, Rogers would write a tune, and then Larry Hart would write words to the tune that existed. That's not how it worked with Hammerstein. Hammerstein was a librettist. He wrote Oklahoma, South Pacific, King and I. He would write all of those shows from beginning to end. He would give it to Richard Rogers, and he'd go back to Pennsylvania. And what's curious, of course, is that those are the shows that are still done. Those are great theatrical masterpieces. The Rogers and Hart shows are not great shows. They're great songs. And so getting back to the opera world, the idea is, so I wrote the libretto. I worked on it for a year and a half or more. I gave it to Jake, and then Jake started writing the music. Now, when he starts writing the music, things change. I'm not suggesting it's, you know, and I know that happened with all these, the canon of opera. But that's how it works. And of course, you know, the real question, I'm in the midst of creating a new piece right now, you know, what I always say, what comes first, the words or the music? The story, and how you tell it. That story I just told about La Boheme, that was the librettist. It's actually, it's, if you can't, she comes up the stairs to get her candle lit, the key falls on the floor, he puts the key in his pocket, he's looking around on the floor. It's how you create those scenes, and then the words, you obviously want the language to be beautiful or appropriate or bespeak the characters, but it's that's the nature of the task.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
About Ahab. Mm-hmm. Ahab is such a complex character, and I always try to emphasize, in some ways, how heroic mm-hmm. he is, because really, he wants to get rid of evil, what has tortured man from Adam on down. He wants life to be happy. He wants us to, I suppose, live eternally. Go back to Eden, and he's it. It's too easy to kind of treat him mm-hmm. as just a madman.
Oh yeah,
and so I'm can't wait to see what you do with him.
Well, I'm glad you said that because it's I completely agree with you, and you'll see the music as I said before is appropriate to underscore here, which is that I said the who is the narrator of an opera? It is the composer. And what you hear in Jake's music are these him struggling with these questions. And also there's the beautiful scene in Act Two when Pip, who's the cabin boy, goes mad, has gone mad. And there's this wonderful scene where he wants, it's from the book, I think the basic structure's from the book, I'll change a little bit, but he wants Pip to go down below. Mm-hmm. And why does he want Pip to go down below? Because Pip is so vulnerable in this, when Pip has sort of lost his mind, that he fears that Pip will trigger sort of the humanity, will call forth the humanity in him. So you watch him struggling with his humanity and with his human, and he doesn't want to let that sort of bubble up because he wants to continue on his journey. So it is woven into
and
the...
And there's that wonderful scene, which I just love in terms of being prophetic of now, because we're still struggling with race, where he says, take my hand,
right.
The black hand mm-hmm. in the white hand forever. I mean, it's just...
Race is definitely a part of the opera, and of course, it's because it's part of it's part of the book. There's a race of fight on the ship, as you know, and it's one of these.
You include that the Midnight Forecastle.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So because it's to me, it seems it's it's partially one of the reasons why this book is so great is because it really, you know, it's right around the time of the Civil War. You know, it's like 10 years before the Civil War, and you know, we're still fighting it right now. I mean, just it's the America. This is the fulcrum of American history, and you know, you have you've got this crazy white guy, you know, full steam ahead.
The other really moving scene for me is the final scene with Starbuck.
That's in the book. It's called the Symphony, and it's in the chapter is called the Symphony. There and is. As I said, that is more cut and pasted from the book than anything in the opera, because it's so beautiful and it so reveals exactly what you're talking about, the humanity of Ahab. And I conflated at the end of it because I had to for obvious reasons, really. But yes, that is a beautiful scene, and it's a beautiful duet between Starbuck, who thinks he might have been able to, you know, kindle the humanity. We're going to go home. We're going to see our kids. We're going to do this. And he almost gets him to believe it, but he can't. He says, you know, what is it? What is it that, you know, who moves this hand? Is it God or is it me? Like, you know, who is, you know, what's happening to me? So all of these struggles to both to be human and to contain to contain your these sort of human impulses we tried to weave into the piece in our 2.5 hours, allotted 2.5 hours.
Yeah, there is one interesting fact about Moby Dick that you probably they're not going to use, but I'd be interested to know if you contemplated doing something with it. And that is when this book was first published in England. There was no epilogue. It ended with the sinking of the ship, and then the waves rolled on like 5,000 years ago. So it's total apocalypse. Right. Everybody's dead, and it goes back to just the earth.
I definitely thought about it. I knew about that, and I thought about it. But I think because of my take on this journey of Greenhorn to Ishmael, I decided to use the
But the epilogue is weird because the epilogue is, it's almost like, okay, Melville said, I wanted it to end with apocalypse, but okay. The problem is there's no narrator. I mean, there is this problem. Well, who's narrating this if Ishmael died, right? Yeah. So that's a big problem.
Right. Yeah.
But if you read the epilogue, and you can, I mean, it's really short, and it's easy, right? But it's very, it's like a romance.
Yeah.
The sharks have clamps on them. The world is, it's almost comic.
Yeah.
Like, it's not real. I mean, the ocean is the site of terror throughout the novel.
Right.
He makes a big point of that, and then all of a sudden, there Ishmael is in the middle of the ocean, and the ocean is this lovely place where sharks have clamps on them and nobody hurts anybody. And Ishmael survives on a life buoy. It's almost like, and the way he survives, it's almost like Queequeg is down there and just shoots it up to him. Thanks.
Yes, sir. I don't do. I mean, the whiteness of the whale is, you know, lingering through the telling of the story. But I don't. I know the chapter you're referring to. I don't. I needed to keep it the drama moving and allow the music to be the thing that elicits those kinds of feelings. Because it's not. This is not about. It's not a talking head kind of experience where we're talking about it. So I'd be curious to know what you think about the whiteness of the whale.
Well, I really emphasize that, and Toni Morrison loves Melville for that. I mean, she sees Ahab, yes, as the absolute hero, because what he wants to kill is the dominance of whiteness and the racial oppression and the association of the whiteness with the dominance of whiteness in the world. And that whole chapter on whiteness is really about finally how whiteness is terroristic, that it can make appalling things even more appalling. And so there is, and that's another aspect of the heroism of Ahab. He wants to kill whiteness and its dominance.
Yes, sir. Well, I think there is, in both of these pieces, both in Cold Mountain and in this one, there's so many issues of community or the social world of the ship, which is a reflection of the social world of America, you know. And so to have the chorus, you know, whether it's singing Lost in the Heart of the Sea or when they're all following Ahab, you know, and Starbuck is trying to beg them to reason with them. So there's ways to use chorus to communicate. Obviously, it's beautiful music. It's beautiful musically, but it's also communicating something that a single voice can't. It's communicating a sense of community, a community gone wrong, community, you know, coming together, a community falling apart, and the cross tensions, as you saw, between like the African, well, the black whalers and the white whalers on the ship, these cross currents. So I was able to use chorus. Jake and I were able to use chorus to create these sort of epic moments, but also moments of societal moments, because that's the ship really does represent the structure of the ship, the way in which different people have their different tasks on the ship, the way in which race is played out on the ship, all these things come together. So we were able to use chorus. I hope we tried to use chorus in a way, and of course the music is so beautiful too. So, yes, ma'am. The whale doesn't get a say, although you'll see the eye of the whale at the end as Ahab is, you know, strapped and is going down. But you know, I don't really think this is about the whale. It's about the human beings, and it's almost the whale is it's certainly not incidental, but the whale represents, you know, something that it's what's the line in Horrible Imaginings? Something from Macbeth. It's just like it represents something, you know, that triggers something that's within the souls of the people on the ship. So the story is a very personal story of what happens on the ship between Ahab and Starbuck, and then ultimately between Queequeg and Greenhorn, and how all these other tributaries sort of flow into the stream of, no pun intended, but flow into the stream of the storytelling.
But that's a really good question, right? Moby Dick told from the point of view of the whale would be fascinating. My students always wonder where the feminine is, and I always say the whale is feminine because nature is feminine, and there's that incredible Grand Armada scene with it, where you see the umbilical cords,
yeah, that's a gorgeous
it's
chapter.
Just full of mothering and nurturance, and of course, Queequeg is a mother man too. He's he's treated as a midwife. He saves everybody, and so there's a lot of feminine values in the
that's true.
Book. But
any other questions?
All right, we'd like to thank Gene and Betsy for coming tonight, and I'd like to thank all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, author Carl Marlantis discusses his recent novel, Deep River. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.